You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Do you remember your sex education? Was it helpful to you? Was it filled with scientific information rather than real, practical advice? I'm Diggory Waite, and this is The Real Sex Education. In this podcast, I'll be interrogating sexual myths, posing sex questions to special guests, and opening up our mailbox to answer your relationship conundrums. In order to do this, though, I need an expert. A sexpert, if you will. But the only sex and relationship therapist I know is my mum. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
Hello, and welcome to The Real Sex Education. I'm Diggory Waite, and I'm joined, as ever, by accredited sex and relationship therapist, Kate Cavill. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
So today's quite a big one, so we're going to have to get straight into it, because there's just too much to talk about here. So it's attachment styles. The reason I know about these is because people talk about them all the time now. I feel like once I heard about them, people are talking to me about them all the time. And in fact, they were recommended, a book on it was actually recommended to me by my now partner. And I ended up, I didn't read the book because I'm dyslexic, but I listened to the whole thing in like a week. What? Are you not impressed? That's good for me.
I thought you were going to say, and I read it in a day. Or in an hour, yeah, no. Or in an afternoon. Oh, I listened to it in a week.
I listened to it and in a week, and it was, yeah. I think it was only like 9 hours to listen to as well. But I managed it. I managed to listen to the whole
well
thing.
Done.
So attachment styles and attachment theory, all that sort of stuff. You teach mm-hmm. it to quite a serious level, right?
Yeah.
So talk to us. What are attachment styles?
Well, the behaviour of somebody and the way they relate to a close other person, and
right.
originally to carers, and then as adults to their partners.
Mm.
It was assessed originally in some research by Mary Ainsworth called the Strange Situation Test, where children aged 14, about 14 to 17 months, were put in a situation where they were playing with their mothers, and then their mothers left the room, and then a stranger would either already be there or would come in and sit there. And then they looked at the reaction that they had with the stranger and also the reaction they had when their parent returned.
And usually it was their mums, right, that went,
yeah.
that came in and out of the room and random strangers that came in and tried to play with them. And so from that strange situation experiment, what did they find out?
Well, they originally noticed three distinct behaviours, which they called ABC. And B is what was called secure attachment, where the child was a bit upset when mum went, but would engage with the stranger, would allow themselves to be comforted, and would quickly resettle when mum came back, be pleased to see her and settle down. A dismissing or avoidant kind of attachment, where the child would not look bothered when the parent went, wouldn't be bothered about engaging with the other person, and wouldn't be particularly bothered when the parent came back. But underneath, their little hearts would be pumping away and they would actually be disturbed, but they just didn't show it.
Yeah.
And that's thought to be because they've learnt that there's no point. So, for instance, if you leave babies to cry themselves to sleep all the time, they know you're not going to come and pick them up, so they won't bother trying to engage. And there may be supportive behaviours like not encouraging emotion, whereas the C type would be upset when mum went, would maybe play with the other person. Difficult to settle, though. Difficult to console. Mm-hmm. And when the mum came back, would really be upset.
Yeah.
And that's often thought to be down to inconsistent parenting. So if you cried, mum would come sometimes and not other times. And so if you thought, well, sometimes she comes, so I'll cry louder. As adults, what people do is they exaggerate. They do the same thing. They exaggerate.
Interesting. And so that one is the sort of anxiously attached or the ambivalent.
Ambivalent or preoccupied. Yeah, it's called. But the names were added by someone called Mary Main, who also did this research, who repeated this research, and also added another one, D, which is the fearful attachment. And this one, when the mother comes back, runs to the mother and will then freeze and drop quite often because it's running to its mum for comfort, but then realises that it's also mum who's frightening and maybe hurts them.
Mum left and created this whole scenario where me and mum are playing and it's great. Then mum leaves and it's like, well, where the hell's she gone? Then a stranger comes in and it's like, well, who the hell's this? And the stranger leaves and the mum comes back and it's like, brilliant, mum's back. And it's like, oh God, but mum started this whole thing.
They run towards her and then go, oh, but it's mum. Mum frightens me and drops in confusion. So that's why it's called disorganised, because it's very confused. And it's a sort of, and they'll behave in ways that are a mixture of A and C types. So avoidant and ambivalent. And people often think that why the fearfully attached are only such a small percentage, according to some research, is because it's thought to be associated with abuse. So people look for some kind of physical or sexual abuse in their past, or something like, you know, having been taken away from their parents or something like that, some big trauma. Whereas actually, they may have been subjected to small trauma, small T trauma, on a chronic basis, which could be quite simple, you know, something like parents who sulk rather than living with parents who argue, having parents who sulk and won't talk to you, particularly in very little children, parents who won't look at them, very, very, very damaging to those children. I mean, it depends on the individual child and their relationship, but it actually doesn't take that much to cause quite a lot of trauma. Not to freak out every parent listening. I know.
A prospective parent.
I know. Yeah. I know. And every time I used to teach attachment, we'd have people running up and down the corridors wailing and...
Yeah, and being like, I've ruined all my...
Yeah, and we all do it. I mean, what Donald Winnicott used to say was that you only have to be a good enough parent. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be wonderful. You can traumatise your children by being... too good. If you were a perfect parent and you were always there ready to blow their nose and, you know, look, pick them up and look after them, they don't believe that they can make decisions for themselves or look after themselves.
But you're a great parent because you've attended to their every need, but they then have no agency or you know, anything like that. So like you say, you need to be good enough. I like that a lot.
And in fact, when D came in, C almost disappeared as a classification because more children were being recognised as fearfully attached or disorganised. Yeah.
Right, because that's interesting because in the book that I read and online, some of the things they talk about, you know, it's they seem to suggest that, and I let me read these out to you because I know you're not going to like these at all. This is what this is what some people say online. Research suggests, they say, that 50 to 60% of people are securely attached, aka what I think people believe is the good one, and the one that you want to try and achieve. You want to be securely attached. 20 to 25% of people are anxious, preoccupied, ambivalent, whatever you want to call that one. 20 to 25% of people are dismissive / avoidant, that A type you're talking about, and just 5 to 10% are fearful avoidant, that last one you're talking about, which doesn't really track with what you're saying.
No, you know, I think there's different research, there's different things, but I think, you know, often children are often seen as securely attached when they're actually avoidant, but because they don't make a fuss and they, you know, they're quiet.
Yeah. So it seems like they're chilled out about everything, but actually inside, like you said, their little hearts are pounding really fast.
And one of the other things about being securely attached, and one of the really important things and why people might want to be that, is because you are able to use the whole range of attachment styles as it is appropriate. So in different contexts, in different circumstances, it might be appropriate to be avoidant or to exaggerate and to make a fuss. I mean, like, for instance, if you're kidnapped, it would be extremely useful to develop Stockholm syndrome, for instance. It would be extremely useful to get on with your kidnappers.
And appear, would that be being sort of like avoidant, as in chilled out, but inside you're freaking out?
Well, no, they might genuinely attach to their caretakers.
Oh, so be securely attached, right.
Yeah, well, they would be attached to their caretakers. And if you came in, you'd go, well, that's messed up because they're kidnappers. But if you're stuck with people, you might as well get on with them. So it makes sense for your brain to say, okay, these people are okay. They're looking after you. They're, you know, just go along with it and it'll all be fine. And that works. Most of our personalities change depending on who we're with, what we're doing. And you will see the more extreme attachment behaviors coming out when people are under pressure, when they're stressed, and when they're in very attached relationships or relationships where they want an attachment or they're in danger of losing an attachment. They behave in particular ways then. We will all adapt to our circumstances if we can. It's when you can't that things go wrong. And actually, in different cultures, these different attachment styles are more appropriate. So the exaggerating one, the ambivalent one, you'll see more often in hot countries.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. But possibly just because they're hot. They're more demonstrative. Just be the way things have developed. There is more dancing and, you know, kind of general frivolity and acting out, which is acceptable. Whereas, you know, in colder countries, it's much more likely for people to be avoidant.
Mm.
And, you know, very extreme behaviours will be appropriate to living in a war zone or, you know, under an oppressive regime or something like that. You might well have a fearful attachment, which would be appropriate because you'd be hypervigilant and you wouldn't be trusting. And that would be an appropriate way to be.
Yeah, because your circumstances are changing every day and people are coming in and out of your life, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Wow,
So these days, it's much less, you know, we try not to pathologize people because of their attachment style. You might notice an attachment style and you might think, oh, you know, that's this making it more difficult to get to know this person because they don't trust me. So as a therapist, you know, obviously, oh, I noticed this attachment style. It's going to be harder to build up trust. That's a useful thing to notice. But then I would want to know why that's happened, why that's been
an appropriate
way for them to develop. And I wouldn't even call it a style anymore. I'd call it attachment behaviour, which may not be there all the time. It may be brought out when you're in the kind of relationship where attachment is a thing. So it's definitely with your therapist, it is a thing.
Mm. Some of the stuff that I've read as well, since talking to you about it, I'll call it like pop attachment theory, where it's like you have an attachment style and it is A, B, C or D. And you are looking to get to B, aka securely attached, because that is the good one.
Mm.
Can I read you some of the stuff that they say about these attachment styles? Because to be fair, I don't think it's all bad, because ultimately these things are trying to help people.
Exactly, yes.
And I think it helped me to some extent as well. Okay, let me read you some of this stuff. So let's say you had a secure attachment style. Characteristics are you have a positive view of yourself and your partners. Yeah. You're comfortable with both intimacy and independence. You're good at communicating your needs and you can trust your partners. The effects that this will have in a romantic relationship is securely attached individuals tend to have healthy and satisfying romantic relationships. They are better at resolving conflicts. They have higher levels of trust and are more likely to form long-lasting partnerships. So that's how the books talk about this stuff.
No, and that's very reasonable. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. And the other thing I'd say is that they're more likely to recover well from a breakup. and not completely ruined by it, because they have faith in themselves. They are independent, they're self-validating. And so they don't need to be in a relationship to feel okay about themselves. They'll be very sad and heartbroken and all of that, but they'll recover well.
Yeah, and they'll respond appropriately, I guess, which is like they will be sad, but they'll be sad for a while and then they'll be able to come to terms with it.
Yes, and they're also able to talk about it and not feel ashamed of it having happened, because a lot of people with insecure attachments feel ashamed of losing a relationship. So they feel, you know, it demonstrates there's something wrong with them. And they feel worthless and very ashamed. Whereas, you know, that's not going to happen to someone who's securely attached, which is why, I guess, people think, oh, that's the way to go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, so, and that's the thing. And that's why, so the book that I read, I now won't maybe name it because maybe I'll be taking shots at it. But it is quite like that. It's like, here are the attachment styles. Here is the one you want. And you can change your attachment style to be more like that if you work really hard at it. And I think there's some interesting stuff in there that maybe we'll get onto. But let's talk, you know, because this is still true that you maybe fall into some of these patterns. So let's talk about other patterns. And if you hear yourself in here, then maybe listen up, because we might be able to talk to you about, you know, how you can change some of these behaviors, or maybe these behaviors, like Mum was saying, are correct for the current situation that you're in. Like it might make sense to display some of these behaviors. We're not going to call them styles because Mum doesn't like styles. But here we go. So here's anxious, preoccupied attachment. So the characteristics are: you often worry about your partner's availability and commitment. Mm. You may be overly concerned about rejection or abandonment, and you might seek constant reassurance and validation. The effects on this in a romantic relationship that you might have is you're often perceived by people as clingy or needy. You often experience more relationship conflicts and emotional ups and downs. You might also have a fear of rejection, quite an intense one, and you may be more likely to end relationships prematurely. Mm. So all of that sounds right.
Mm. And people are often very much in their own heads and you know, imagining what they want to happen and then being upset with the other person when they don't do what they were imagining, because they, you know, sometimes confuse reality and fantasy. That, you know, there's a very thin dividing line. So if you're imagining that your partner's going to give you a bunch of flowers on your birthday and they give you a box of chocolates, you might be furious with them when they didn't know that they were required to bring a bunch of flowers. They didn't know at all. But you've been imagining it in your head. And so expecting it to happen, and then very, very, very disappointed when it doesn't. So disappointed that you might be angry with the person.
Yeah, which isn't good. So on the other end of the spectrum, the dismissive, avoidant attachment behavior, the characteristics are: they tend to downplay the importance of emotional intimacy and independence. Mm-hmm. They're uncomfortable with emotional expression. They prefer to keep their distance in relationships. Effects in romantic relationships are: they struggle with forming deep emotional connections. They may seem emotionally distant and avoid discussing feelings. They often have difficulty with commitment, and their partners may feel neglected or unimportant.
Yeah. And often when you start a relationship, I mean, weirdly, people with ambivalent attachment are often very attracted to people who are avoidant, because they seem very secure, and they seem like, you know, somebody who could make them feel better, because they seem very reliable. But actually, they're often not at all interested in any kind of acting out or clingy or needy behavior. And they might close that down or ignore it or stay away. And they won't necessarily think, oh, that person seems a bit anxious. They might want to hear from me. They might want to text every day or something like that. Or they might expect a return text as soon as they've texted. They could leave it hours or days before they reply, which will be sending the other person around the twist. Yeah.
Rather bend. I mean, and that's the thing. They talked about this in the book that I read, that in romantic relationships, it's a nightmare between these two, because I think the suggestion was that the anxiously or ambivalently attached person, you know, let's say clings on and wants constant reassurance. Mm. And the avoidant person, they're in their own world. They think that independence is king. And they don't want to detach themselves too close to anything, because at the end of the day, the only person they can trust is themselves, or whatever. So it's a nightmare situation because that makes the ambivalent person, anxious person, cling on more, and it makes the avoidant person step
detach
away more.
Detach
more. And so it's this constant thing. And because avoidants are avoidant and do this, they're getting broken up with, or they're constantly in the dating pool because that keeps happening. Or people get too close to them and they go, nah, it's time to break up. So you're going to meet a lot of these guys and gals. Similarly, like we talked about before, the anxious, ambivalent, preoccupied people are also ending a lot of these relationships because they're concerned about rejection or abandonment. So to get in there first, they're ending these relationships. So the dating pool is filled with people like this. And so and they keep meeting with each other and it keeps being a nightmare.
And they've been far more interested in having a relationship rather than the quality of the relationship sometimes. I mean, you know, at the extreme end, it's all a spectrum.
Yeah.
But if they feel they've been let down, sometimes they will just go, I'm never speaking to you again. That's it.
Wow, there you go. So then, and then the last one, that D that we were talking about, the fearful avoidant or disorganized attachment. The characteristics are people with fearful avoidant attachment have a combination of anxious and avoidant traits. They often desire close relationships but are afraid of getting hurt or rejected. So it's that double thing here where it's like they want the close relationships but they don't want to get hurt or rejected. They may experience emotional turmoil. They have difficulty trusting others. The effects this has in romantic relationships is they can have tumultuous relationships, which are really close at one moment and then quite far off in the next. They may experience intense highs and lows. They push their partners away when they get too close and then yearn for closeness again. And their relationships can be marked by confusion and instability.
Yeah. And if you think about the avoidant part of that, they will often be afraid of commitment or more likely to have an affair or something like that because they're afraid of being found out and rejected. So they may, you know, they may have affairs. They quite often go off sex once they're in the relationship. They're okay with sex in a casual relationship. But once they're into a more committed relationship, quite often it's very difficult to get them to have sex because they are afraid they won't get it right. They're afraid they'll be rejected. And they actually quite often just lose their libido. They just don't have any desire. And that keeps them safer. Whereas the more ambivalent ones will quite often have a lot of casual sex and may be dangerous, you know, even put themselves in risky positions because they're looking for the feeling of validation they get from being close to somebody in a sexual situation. They quite often say they have very high sex drive. They also see themselves as very empathic usually, and they will they want to talk a lot and explain things. And their partners, if they're avoidant, don't want to talk a lot and explain anything.
Yeah.
So when you get that combination, even more extreme in the fearfully attached people, then that can actually, you know, lead to violence or, you know, abuse because it feels so important to them that their needs are met because they're so used to their needs not having been met in the past. So you will find that it's much more difficult for any of the sorts of behavior that aren't secure. It's going to be more difficult to have a sexual relationship or a close loving relationship because trust is an issue and fear of being found out and fear of rejection are all issues in those relationships.
So you're saying that if you show these attachment behaviors, your relationships could be more problematic. How do we stop that? If people have listened to this and they thought, ooh, that one does sound like me, what do you do to minimize some of that stuff?
So being able to be curious about what's going on for you is probably the most important thing you can do. So before you react, if you can, get used to knowing your body scan occasionally so that you get to know how your body feels when it's calm and then start to know when you're starting to not feel calm. Because whatever the trigger is, it might come from within you. It might be a thought you've had. It might be, you know, anything could trigger somebody and they become dysregulated and then start to think that that's been caused by the other person, by a partner or something like that. They become dysregulated and they look to somebody else to make them feel okay. Whereas what you need to do is learn ways of managing your own feelings before you start looking to someone else to help you. You know, you can turn up the volume a little bit on how you appreciate other people. If you're avoidant, how you appreciate other people, how you, you know, negotiate time for yourself, which you may well need.
Yeah.
So you can turn up the volume a bit on your emotion, or you can turn it down a bit if you're too needy and too ready to shout.
So then for the anxiously attached person, if I was feeling like that and I was like, oh, my emotions were really high and I wanted to act out, basically you're just sort of saying, I'm going to turn that down, calm.
Well, no, if you're in a situation with partners where this is happening, I would generally say walk away from one another for a moment.
Not all together.
No. If you're feeling the emotion rising and you feel like you're going to go out of control, where you may say things, and bear in mind, if you're ambivalently attached, you're going to exaggerate. You're going to say, get out. And then the next day when they've gone, you'll say, what? You've abandoned me. You know, that happens all the time. Think, okay, something's about to happen here. We're about to have an argument. I'm just going to walk away and calm down. And you go away, do your breathing exercises or whatever it is you do. Call somebody, but not to complain about your partner, just to have a chat about something completely different. And don't get in a car and drive off because you're angry. Just, you know, walk away. And, you know, very quickly people tend to return to normal. They calm down and then they can think, what did I actually want to get out of this conversation? And what do I actually need? Do I need a hug? In which case, don't expect your partner to mind read, but maybe go and ask for a hug. They may still be worked up and say, well, I'm not hugging you because you've just been shouting at me. But, And if you feel you need space, ask for the space. It generally tends to be the case that if you are the kind of person that doesn't like to talk too much, you're more of a reflector. You'll do well with somebody who gives you space to have a think and then come back to you. Rather than says, I'm really empathic and I'm telling you all this stuff about me. Why aren't you reciprocating? Why aren't you telling me all about you? I want to hear about your feelings. And you want to know about their feelings to make yourself feel okay.
I have to be honest. I feel like that's not how I've done well in the past. When serious conversations are happening, I'm always like, I need to think about this. I don't want to say anything that I need to really reflect, work out what's going on before I really properly engage in this. But I like that a lot. So then on the other end of the spectrum, the avoidant attachment behaviors, interestingly that you say turn up the stuff. So if you're in a relationship and you're like, okay, I shouldn't pull myself away from them too much, maybe I should do a few things for them,
feel a bit more involved. Be a bit more involved. I mean, what people often say is, well, why am I always doing all the arranging, carrying the mental load for the family? You know, whereas you're just going your own sweet way and not noticing what's needed, because maybe they're very involved in their work or something, and they've their own stuff, and they don't see the need to be constantly monitoring the relationship and how it's going, because they just assume that everything's fine, because they may well be quite detached from their feelings. You've got to remember that if you're not securely attached, you're going to be scared, right?
Yeah.
Your relationships don't feel safe, because the whole point is this is about security. Originally, John Bowlby came up with the idea of attachment theory, and he didn't talk about secure attachment. He talked about threat. He talked about children feeling threatened. And of course, you know, publishers didn't like the sound of that, because you're not going to tell a whole load of parents they're dangerous. Their behavior towards their children is creating this danger. So that's why they came up with this idea of being securely attached. So we're talking about people that don't feel secure. They may have repressed that feeling so that on an everyday basis they do feel secure. That's would be people who are more avoidant. But actually, they're not feeling secure. So that every time they are engaging in a relationship, they're taking a lot of risks because they're expecting something bad to happen. So whether they're conscious of that or it's unconscious, they are expecting something bad to happen.
And
it's very true that if you live with somebody who's securely attached, you will become more securely attached.
Because you're just feeding off their good vibes.
Because all the threat is taken away. The threat's no longer there. This is all about managing threat and making the world around you safer and taking away your feelings of shame or unworthiness or not good enoughness. You know, once you feel better about yourself, you will be able to have a happier, more gentle and loving relationship. And you won't be putting up barriers that actually keep you apart. You know, you find often with couples that they'll say, one will say, for instance, I'm constantly talking about things and want to have proper discussions about emotions and I want more sex. And you're just refusing all of those things. If they swap and the other one says, oh, actually, you're dead right. I do want more sex. I do want to talk more about my emotions. The other one will go, well, not now. You're not doing it in the right way. That's not how I wanted it. And they'll run for the hills. They quite often will swap over because this is not one doing it to the other. This is a couple who have developed a dynamic that stops them from getting on. Because if they did get on, then the enormous threat of losing one another would happen. And this is a way of managing that. That they behave in these particular ways by arguing or whatever it is.
Bloody hell.
I know.
That's so friggin', it's just mad, isn't it? That we do that to ourselves.
It's really logical.
But you're like, I guess it makes sense, but in the way that it's sort of like, you know, you're going to be together, but you're going to almost purposely not get on, because if you did get on too well, you'd be scared about how well you got on and that you might lose that at some point.
But a lot of this is unconscious. I mean, you know, or semi-conscious, of course. But mainly unconscious. Mm. And people just know they just feel rotten. I mean, if you feel safe enough to have a conversation where you ask one another what you think you need, that would be the thing to do. But I mean, if you're talking about people who are in a therapy situation, that's exactly what they do. They will hopefully feel safer to talk about the needs. But one of the ways that therapists make it feel safer is they'll go, oh, this one's the avoidant one. And so I will be a bit brighter with that person and a bit more smiley and bright and to bring them up, to make them feel this is safe, this is okay, nothing intense going on here. She's not going to start delving around wanting to know all about my relationship with my mother. She's just chatting. So this feels safe.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden they're talking their heads off and their partner's going, what the hell's going on there? He never does this.
Yeah. Meanwhile,
it could be a woman. It's whereas with the other one, first of all, you pay more attention, first of all, to the avoidant one because they're watching you really carefully. They actually care about appearances. So they're kind of watching to see that you're okay. The ambivalent one is so preoccupied with themselves and their feelings, they're not noticing what you're doing. So they might say, why are you talking to him? Why are you looking at me like that? They might take offence. But generally speaking, they're looking to see what's happening to me. How am I going to be made to feel better? So with that one, you'd be much more, that sounds really difficult. You'd be much more very quiet, classic. bringing them down, saying, gosh, you know, that must be awful. I can see how you're feeling. That must be really hard. And how are you coping with that?
How does that make you feel?
Yeah, I try and avoid that, actually. And I also try to avoid putting my head on one side. Yeah. But there is that tendency. But you're much more soothing tone. The other one doesn't want a soothing tone. He wants someone to be bright and cheerful. But, you know, and it's absolutely fine to discuss the differences, to say you're a much more self-contained person and you're a much more emotional person and a sensitive person. And therefore, you've got these huge differences. So you need to learn how to look after yourselves, because to some extent, we have to be realistic. You're not going to meet one another's needs. You have to ask for what you want and you have to be available to give. You have to be comfortable with the giving and the taking.
Mm-mm.
And to begin with, you have to learn how to look after yourself, and they both need that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd just say as well, like, you know, if you're sat there at home thinking about what attachment behavior you might be showing in your romantic relationships and stuff, one thing that we've already talked about there is I know that I've displayed different ones throughout my life with different partners, and so these things can chop and change. So it's not like this is me, you know. And like Mum said, it's different contexts, different people bring out different sides of you, different contexts in your own life bring out different sides of you. But we should probably leave it there, because otherwise we could just keep talking about this for ages. So thank you so much for listening, everyone. Please do let us know if you have any more questions on that, because I feel like in some ways, the longer you talk to Mum about this, the more questions you have. she's answered all my questions on my little sheet, but I've written down a few more, but maybe we'll do another episode another
day. Gosh, I hope all my clients aren't going to be looking and saying, oh, you know, are you being bouncy with me and soothing with my partner?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like you talk to me like this, and then suddenly you go like that to my partner.
Yeah.
At least they know now. I've given them a little look behind the curtain.
Oh, dear. Yeah. All the trade secrets.
Exactly. Yeah, we should spill them more on the podcast, actually. Mm. Then people wouldn't have to pay for therapy. Wouldn't that be great? You can't be upset with that because you're meant to be making people feel better. Wonderful. Yes, please get in touch with us on our social media channels. We're at the RSC Pod. And make sure you subscribe wherever you're listening now so you can get the next episode of The Real Sex Education next time. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Real Sex Education, which is hosted by Diggory Waite and Kate Campbell. The show is produced by Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. The Real Sex Education is a Hattrick podcast.
This podcast is based on the real-life relationship between Diggory Waite and his mother, accredited sex therapist Kate Campbell. The show is therefore inspired by, but otherwise unrelated to, the TV show Sex Education. But yes, Diggory does wish his mother was played by Gillian Anderson.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.